Okay, this is continuing with Patricia Leslie Foster on 29 May 1981. Now, we were discussing the observational procedure that you could do it pretty much automatically, but then you still had strip chart recordings. You didn't have input to a computer in that day, is that right? Now, it's John Blythe did use a computer a few years before this time, but do I gather then that the computer was not being used in general? That's right.
Now, SI-1 was on approach, and was very heavily loaded with all people did. And part of the tradition then, of using it, there were people around in the other half of the room, in the holiday section, who used to use the idea.
I see.
But I don't think I myself did anything on the computer.
I see, okay. So you had a lot of work to do with the strip chart recordings then?
Well, they don't by hand.
Right. Let me understand the relationship of the survey that you were doing relative to the what became the 4C survey. Was this a trial, more or less, for that, or...?
Well, there were two trials. I don't know what the politics were, and I'm looking back. The point was that, obviously, 4C went to take more time. In order to do 4C properly, the antenna on railway line had to be moved to a specific position block, and it would take 4 times as long as it was. I don't know how long it was, 16 times as long as the survey that I did. And I think the idea was to do a trial to see that all was well and it produced respectable answers. And indeed, some of the work was valuable, I think, in that it helped with some identification work.
Right.
Long before 4C actually came out.
Right.
4C didn't come out to me later.
And that's the survey that you published with Elsmore and Ryle in 59.
Well, no, that was a different matter.
Oh, that's a different... Well then, let's see, I'm getting confused. I do have your thesis here, but I thought that was in your thesis also.
So it is, but it was put down as part of the general run of the book.
I see.
And quite a different text.
Well, let's go back to the let's not get off onto that other survey then, we'll come back to that. The main thing for your thesis then was this angular size thing, using it for as a total power instrument and as an interferometer. All right. And what would you say were the main scientific results from that survey?
I think you probably have to realize that by this time I myself realized that I wasn't actually walking into the problem.
Yeah, I see.
I'm interested in making stuff work. But I really wasn't always interested in the results.
Right, I see.
So that while I can remember the sort of fine details of calibration technique, still, the results of my thesis wrapped in fog.
Right. Well, okay, I understand what you're saying. Well, let's talk about the calibration. What were the primary problems in calibrating?
There were two things. One, of course, was you had to make sure the angle was right, and you worked out, the accuracy of the actual position for a small degree.
Yes.
And the other was just a straightforward calibration as we did by noise methods which was a system which injected noise into the system.
Right.
Then you had some method of translating the strip chart from day to day. And it took a fair amount of time to get that going. As this is just a recollection, but I don't think there was anything particularly bad about the system. I think what it was that when I went there, the Lord Vistacycle knew and all the cables and everything had to be laid.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, I helped with that and the cable calibration, etc. And it all took a very long time. It was part of the general telescope commissioning procedure.
Right, right. So this was really amongst the very first observations, and therefore there were a lot of new things that had to be found out.
That's right. There was all the cables had to be matched and things like this. It was very complicated. Feeders for both the bits of the telescope.
And one thing I read in your thesis was that you calibrated this automatic gain control by injecting known amount of noises with scans at five or six different declinations. And I was surprised that you only needed to do that many different declinations. I would have thought that you would have to do more. Was that simply because the beam was so broad? And
the beam in elevation is pretty broad.
So I guess that's right. That really was all the independent information that was there. I was thinking that the sky varied more rapidly than that, but the beam was so large, yes. Okay. You also worked on this other survey that I mentioned before that was published with Elsmore and Ryle. Can you tell me what the...
That's a great question.
Can you tell me about that?
Well, the I can't remember whether I got about half of the or whether we got the full but it was quite clear then that the position, you know, it was quite a very stable instrument and you could do quite well on it. And it was decided that by doing various sort of special things, you could measure, and taking great care, you could measure a few positions extremely accurately.
Right.
And it was decided to do 64 volts, and the experiment was in fact devised by Bruce Elmore.
Mm-hmm.
I recall the little antenna was stuck at various positions, so as to give us a diagonal line. And I think there was something like three positions, so maybe wrong for all kinds of
things.
Certainly, a great deal of effort went into it because we, swung the antenna around like mad, and the whole thing was a great deal of hard work. And there was a strip chance going. There were people cycling around at midnight.
In order to get all hours...
change the elevation of the antenna. And that was it.
I see. I see. But now you said that Elsmore set it up such that there were going to be 64 sources. Was that a predetermined number, are you saying?
64 sources was the maximum number that we could quote. I think how you pick the sources was to look down, starting at brightest, look down at this, and try and fit in the maximum number in 24 hours.
I see. From the 3C list.
Yes.
I see. And this was really to help with the optical identification problem primarily?
Yes, it was. It was trying to get very accurate information for
And you did discuss some of the various problems with optical identifications and some of the smaller projects that you worked on that were published in Observatory.
Yes.
You obviously were interested in... tying things in.
Quite a bit of work done on that. Came out from various things, not least from the angular diameter information. There were one or two interesting things that I remember, which I did in things like IC+3.
Right, and the Perseus cluster and so forth. But now, did you have a special interest in the optical identifications? It would seem so from these... from these smaller articles that you published?
I don't think so. I don't remember.
Because you were talking about Cygnus loop.
That's right. There were quite a few. I think it was partly that perhaps it was the first survey that had been done, which had been done with sufficient resolution to actually have a look at the structure of some of these bigger sources.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I see. Now, one thing I wanted to ask was that there was not actually a date on the copy of your thesis that is in the group. Was it 1960? You do say that you had this fellowship from 1957 to 60, but there's no actual date on the thesis. You say you had more of an interest in the radio techniques than in the astronomy, but you did then go on and join a radio astronomy group, did you not?
I did indeed, yes.
I don't have any information on any publications after from my bibliography. It ends in 62, but you did join the group in Malvern.
Yes, and again, I did a whole group on
Can you tell me what the situation of the group was when you joined it? Was that in 61 then?
When I was another citizen, there were two little babies in the house, and they just got to be the mountain, and they were just doing it. And effectively, I turned up and designed the mission for the
I see.
Although I didn't, of course, really talk to the people who were already from the bubble.
Right. Right, now who was the person that was behind setting this up? So that was Hayes. So he had decided to get back into radio astronomy then. And there had been no actual measurements made at Malvern in the late 50s or before you arrived.
Certainly not on the telescope, but these were totally new.
I see. Oh, I see. They were not being used for anything else. They were just built for radio astronomy. And what they were something like 75 feet diameter. And what were the primary results that came out of that in those couple years, or how long did you continue to work with that group for quite a while, or? Okay, my study ends just about this time, about mid 60s. So. If you could tell me what the primary things were that you worked on during those 3 years.
Well, again, we did a great deal of astrophysical work. And this was fed into the optical identification paper, and the panel was quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because this was an even longer base than we wanted to use before. And there was quite a bit of work done on Jupiter as well.
What was the frequency, main operation? Mm-hmm. Well, this was very similar, was it not, to Caltech, who was operating at that kind of a frequency, sometimes a little bit higher, with similar baselines. Now, who were the people that were in the group besides Hay? Mm-hmm. Now, you say that Gent was the leader of the group, although Hay set it up, so he did not actually take a day-to-day part.
No, he didn't. He was not to be in that.
I see. I see. Well, that pretty much covers the scientific-type questions I wanted to ask. I would like to ask about the Cambridge group itself, as to what you see as the having come in as a raw student, so to speak, and then gone away as a radio astronomer, what do you see as the key to the success to the Cambridge group, from your experience?
Well, it's very difficult to tell. I mean, in those days, there were very few radio astronomers. The problem was not to be discovered.
I guess
most of them were
pretty successful. Well, that's very true, but nevertheless, there were some that were more successful than others. You didn't feel there was any special quality that...
Well, one did, but one of the water, don't you?
I see.
It means the sense that with a group of people who are working under adverse conditions, if you don't all believe very much that you are the best thing, you're trying to rest.
Yes.
You won't do so well.
Right, right. Right, no. No, that's a very good point.
Whether it was actually true is another matter.
Right, right. Did you have any contact with other groups?
Yes, I had quite a lot to do with jobs. They called legal measures and hanging diameters. And of course, they were also creating diameters using a different technique.
And longer baselines.
And longer baselines.
Right.
But they didn't have the basic high resolution that we had, which was very helpful.
Mm-hmm. And what?
So what we were doing was trying to interleave arms of everybody and put down some problems in some corporate investments.
Right, and who was the main person or people you were working with there?
Somebody called Henry
Palmer. Oh, yes, right.
And there was somebody, you know.
Morris or Thompson? Or?
Thompson.
Yes.
No,
Dick Thompson, I mean. Dick Thompson. I think he may have actually left by the time. He was the first of that group, but I think he did leave in 57 or 58, yeah.
Well, I obviously, you research students don't get to meet people like Palmer. I probably get to meet him until about probably 58, 59.
Yeah.
When things were going to probably 59.
In any case, there was a close degree of cooperation on this between Jodl and the Cavendish group.
There was quite a lot. There was quite a lot of doing and throwing favors to that. And I certainly went up to visit Jodl and told me that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't actually I can't really remember what it was we did together. We certainly never published any papers. But it was certainly, you know, quite a degree of sort of this is the way we do things and then telling us what they did.
You mean comparing techniques? I see. I was thinking that it would be combining data, more or less, at different baselines. And
I don't know that John Whitehead has actually ever got around to that, because I've got a feeling that they have got quite the car along the line, and they're just setting their thing up.
I see. So you weren't comparing flux density scales and...
No, we weren't doing
that. I see.
I didn't know what they were doing, because they were going after very long baselines and contributing to their results.
Right, right. Let me just go back to your very interesting remark about camaraderie and so forth, but you said under adverse conditions. Now, are you speaking about the usual postgraduate student feeling like he works too much?
No. I mean, radio astronomy in the late 90s, it was a very outdoor thing. And you went out and you sort of got soaked when you moved the antenna.
I see. And
it was hard physical labor.
And weird hours and so forth. Yeah. Right. Right, right. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, that's about all I wanted to cover. Did anything that you'd like to say, or things that you think that I should ask him of? Okay. Well, thank you very much.